Good afternoon. Thank you. Good to be here. So Aurora Omoa was the evaluator on the project that I'm going to talk about. So she originally submitted our abstract and just couldn't be here today. She's working on her doctorate, finishing that up, but I'm happy to be here and talk about this pilot program in licensed childcare facilities in the District of Columbia, working on environmental health training education program. I don't have any relationships to disclose. And I always like to start with a nice inspirational thought, especially now that I see the sun is out, and I don't know how much warmer it is, but if you could just kind of keep this in the back of your mind as we continue our discussion, every American deserves to have a clean, safe, and healthy environment. Today we understand better than ever before that our health is not only dependent on what happens in the doctor's office, but is determined by the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the communities we call home. So the quick outline of what I'm going to discuss today, just a little bit on the background, the methods, and the results and discussion, again, to this pilot child care intervention program. Here's a map of the District of Columbia. For those of you that don't know, the district is broken into 8 wards. Each of those wards have their own demographics and characteristics. Unfortunately, there are some that are notorious, wards 6, 7, and 8, for having some of the highest rates of childhood asthma and childhood lead poisoning and many other societal challenges, although the district as a whole has some of the highest childhood asthma rates and childhood lead poisoning concerns, just for some background. I think Max also went over a lot of why children are vulnerable, but just as a grounding place, we do know that exposure to environmental hazards of many different forms have been linked to asthma, various forms of cancer later on in life, and neurodevelopmental disorders. Children definitely are more susceptible in many cases to environmental health exposures because of their size, their behavior, their hand-to-mouth behavior, and their ongoing development. And we know that many children in this country, 60% or more, and that's documented in licensed childcare facilities, spend several hours a day, roughly talking about 13 million preschoolers, and that's 6 million infants and toddlers in some form of licensed childcare. And again, that's not talking about the grandma down the street, the aunt over here that's taking in 5 or 6 kids, so let's just keep that in perspective. It's a lot of kids that are in early learning, anywhere from 6 weeks to 5 years of age in this country. The reason that we got into this over 10 years ago is that not much attention has been focused on that specific cognitive learning time, developmental time of a child, which is very key considering their exposures in those facilities are very detrimental, potentially, and or uplifting to their health. There are not a lot of peer-reviewed literature out in early learning and related to environmental health exposures, but there is a HUD survey on child care centers that showed that 14% of the few centers that were looked at in that survey did actually have high levels of lead. I know that Asa Bradman at UC Berkeley in the last couple of years, and he's on our science advisory committee to our work, has found formaldehyde, volatile organic compounds, a lot of other very nasty things, at high prevalence over high thresholds in early learning child care facilities. So the rationale, again, is that we very much needed to look at the places where children are spending a lot of time that we didn't, and we still don't know too much about, but we're growing in that literature. There are many reluctancies here. Child care providers are not getting environmental health education in any type of standard way. There are certainly some states, Indiana's 5-star program, for example, that was very supportive to us and has been very helpful in our growth in this work, that are doing some things along with other states in the country. But as a general mode across the gamut of child care providers and trainers and facility managers and owners are not getting environmental health 101, if you will. But we do know that we've had lots of success in the field of public health on training environmental health of our healthcare practitioners, our nurses, our docs. That continues to happen. Of course, our public health advocates and leaders and policymakers, while that continues. So certainly our rationale is that we can continue in this training to assist the child care realm in understanding and identifying and hopefully reducing and or eliminating in a low to no cost way known environmental hazards in their centers. So we had already done a pilot of our child care curriculum in California and Georgia prior to moving into D.C. Thanks to some funding from the District of Columbia Centers for Disease Control, we helped to establish the Healthy Environments for Child Care and Preschools program and then set up an advisory committee made up of child care professional experts, public health experts. We had our local pediatric environmental health specialty unit involved, local citizens, and on to help guide us on this project. The program consisted of a training component and an environmental assessment component. The training was roughly 2 hours. And we put together environmental health modules, again, based on some of the best practices in school, environmental health education assessments and training tools that are out there, as well as home training tools. Our curriculum at that time was based on 14 science-based interactive modules on environmental health hazards. And we talked, of course, about what is the issue, why is the issue concerning to children, what is the potential route of exposure, and as a provider, facility owner, or facility manager, what can you be doing to really make some low to no cost steps to prevent or reduce that exposure in your facility. And then we had an 18-item pre- and post-knowledge training assessment evaluation that we also provided before and after each training. This was the questionnaire. I won't go through all of them, but you'll see it's a very broad gamut of lots of different topics in the field of children's environmental health, even down to art supplies and cleaning supplies. The other side of this program was the environmental health assessments. Again, they were conducted before and after the training. So we'd go, we'd meet with the facility owner, we would get their input, get their agreement to voluntarily, this is all voluntary, engage in this training program and assessment program. We would then give them a pre-assessment walk. We would conduct a 90-minute pre-assessment walkthrough, which would also include interviewing the facility owner to get a better sense of their practices and procedures in that center. And then the staff would all be trained with our curriculum, and then we go back another 3 to 6 months later, sometimes 9 months, depending on the scheduling, to then do the same walkthrough post-environmental health assessment. And this was conducted in 60 licensed childcare centers between 2007 and 2010. And we created an environmental assessment tool based on the Healthy Homes and Healthy Schools concepts and the National Center for Healthy Homes Pediatric Environmental Health Assessment Survey. And that evaluation consisted of 12 subsections. So the 18-item knowledge test was graded on a percent scale. We looked at the change in mean in the pre- and post-knowledge scores by using a paired T-test. And we used the McNemers test to look at the pre-test and the post-test in each of the 18 questions and how each respondent answered, either correctly or incorrectly pertaining to each topic. So the environmental assessments were scored in three different ways. They had low risk, they were given 0 points. If they were determined to have medium risk, it was 3 points. High risk, 5 points. The total risk scores were then aggregated for each of the 12 environmental health sections in the environmental assessment. And the final risk scores were estimated by aggregating all of the 12 subsections. So we had two different categorizations of the child care centers as they were answering their questions. First, determined on their answers, either they were leveled as an increased risk, meaning the answers that they gave put them at an increased risk for various exposures to the children that they're serving, or reduced risk. Their practices and procedures, as reported, were not deemed as risky as some of the others. And also, we compared the change in the mean test scores for the increased risk and those reduced risk groups. And there was an ANOVA analysis of variance testing that was done to look at the knowledge test difference between the pre- and the post-test knowledge test that they took. Here's just a quick summary of the results and some of the geographic. We looked at, again, 60 centers representing just under 590 childcare children in childcare facilities in D.C., all the way down to the number of those diagnosed with asthma in those centers before we started our work with them. Here are some of the knowledge assessments reporting. So the blue line, which had a pointer up here at the top, those are the numbers that answered the pre-test questions correctly. The red one are the corrected post-test answers. So you'll see that those were close. They varied in some way, but they were close. The green line are those that answered incorrectly in the pre-test, and then the purple line, it should be purple, on the bottom, answered incorrectly in the post. So you'll see that what's good is that not many people were answering by the end of our intervention still this information in an incorrect way. So you'll see where we did definitely prove that the intervention of the education training alone did certainly increase the overall environmental health understanding and education of these child care providers. These are the various topics that were covered in the facility assessment, and what's also good is that the numbers pretty much went the way that we would hope that when we first started working with them, even if there wasn't much of a knowledge in the area, you saw an improvement in that area of their basic understanding of what the concern was and, more importantly, what they could be doing about it. So that was very favorable. So the key findings, there was a significant change in the mean for the pre and the post knowledge scores. So again, just about, we saw a nice trend of those that maybe increased their baseline information of environmental health or increased their overall environmental health understanding per our 2 hours with them in our training, which was great. And there was a significant increase in the number of child care providers that were answering their questions correctly. So again, not everyone had everything right, but you definitely had a higher percentage of those answering correctly in the post-test. And in the four sections that were looked at for the environmental assessments, in general cleansing, the way that they were cleaning the facility, pest prevention, lead paint, pesticides, and what we grouped as other chemicals and mercury, all found the biggest ranges of increase in their understanding and also their actions pertaining to the understanding. And when we look at association between training and environmental assessment, those centers with the increased risk showed a significant increase, and those centers with reduced risk also showed significant increase. So again, this, you know, this is how we could have hoped that this would have gone, but it really, this intervention proved to be very successful. Overall, the training was immediately effective, and we actually heard that even from individual reporting as well as what was reported on their evaluations. There were comparatively higher scores on asthma and allergies, which does not surprise me because out of all the environmental health issues, asthma, generally speaking, is covered in some shape or form, usually because so many children now are asthmatic. But again, the environmental linkages to asthma are usually what's missing. And of course, all those other topics that I mentioned are usually almost frequently missing from environmental health, from training and education standards related to childcare. There are key factors of concern that were ongoing. In the district, you know, like childhood asthma, like I mentioned, childhood lead poisoning. So what we saw is a lot of the concerns that people were increasing their education and training on are simultaneously also working with the high risk factors in the district, which was also a benefit to those communities. And I should say we spent an intensive amount of time making sure that in those wards 6, 7, and 8, we had increased representation of the 60 child care facilities that were integrated into this program. We had centers from representing all of the 8 wards, but in particular, we made specific effort to really make sure we were reaching to the lower income and those wards that are having some of the highest problems in the district. The challenging concepts continue to include in areas around asbestos and VOCs, volatile organic compounds. Those tended to still be very cumbersome for people to digest. And the general concept of the built environment, which again is not surprising. Many of us in this room and beyond are continuing to work on how do we best communicate in general what environmental health is, and certainly these catch-all areas like built environment. We know that a childcare facility is an example of a built environment, but translating that to the general public and what that means, and more importantly, the many nuances found in the built environment is still, I think, a challenge before all of us. On the facility assessments, both general cleanliness and lead paint corresponded to the highest scores observed for corresponding questions on the knowledge assessment. So between asthma a little bit and definitely lead, there seemed to be a good understanding, generally speaking, if I had to pick through that entire list. The others, not so much. And there was definitely a significant improvement in areas that were easily resolved. So the more easily that the science-based recommendation, the easier the step was to take, the easier it was for those facilities, obviously, to do. And, of course, the less costly that it was, the quicker they were actually able to make some change. And I will say, on the second environmental assessment, we asked them, you know, what were some actual things that you did? And we documented some of those. Some folks, for example, put in a no-idling policy, where in some cases, especially in the cold weather, you'll have parents that pull up, they don't want to turn off their car. They'll leave the car idling because they think, you know, it's a warmer car they can bring their child back to. But, of course, the vents and everything else and the doors that are opening are all that – all those fumes are going right into the facility. In some cases, you can't prevent your workers from smoking, but in many cases, they would implement or encourage, and this is already in child care standards, but they would encourage through our encouragement also to go out, put on a second or third layer, making sure you're removing that layer before you then, you know, of course, washing your hands and then picking up young toddlers or infants. I mean, so those were things that just required internal policy. In many cases, too, we encourage them, you know, don't have all kinds of cleaning supplies brought in. Sometimes the child care providers want to bring in their own products because it's what they use at home, but that you have no control of what is being used, you know, how often it's being used, that kind of thing. So having more of a structured standard that aligns with, in some cases, what child care standards already call for, had a nice alignment with the environmental health benefits as well. And again, due to high turnover of staff, there's definitely a need to continue consistent training because there is a revolving door when it comes to childcare facilities. Childcare licensing happens in the facility, but also individual providers have to be licensed. So they can move with their licensing. They can move to a different facility. And so if you spend a lot of time training that group, and then some of them move on, you've now lost some of that historical reference. So also future programs should definitely target, of course, unlicensed, and that's something we're very much aware of. Tracking them is a little bit harder, but usually most of the regions know in many cases who those folks are. They might still come to events, but there's various reasons as to why they're not licensed, which is the concern. Some of the limitations here, the time commitment, this was all voluntary. I equate the time of child care providers to that of healthcare providers. Some of them in D.C. are open 24 hours a day. They don't have maybe the same staff, but due to the federal government schedule and three different shifts, they have to be available for people that quickly have to go and get called in. Some facilities open at 5, 6 a.m. They don't close to 6, 7 p.m. Then they're going home to their own families. They don't have the luxury of looking online and checking out things that are voluntary and don't already adhere to their mandated responsibilities. So we're working very hard to make sure that environmental health is incorporated into their regular standard of conduct as a child care facility. The resources are limited. In general, I mean, we wish we could have brought in more than 60 centers, but it was so staff intensive to just bring in the 60, that's what we had to go with at that time. At times, attendance was not, we weren't sure, especially on the weekends. Sometimes it was hard to find a facility on the weekends that were open and that didn't charge us an arm and a leg just to host our training there. And of course, the bottom line too is that because this is voluntary, there was a lot of reluctancy in general. If I let you in, and I might think you guys are great and everything, but what about the test results? What are you going to do with those? Am I going to be closed, in 2 weeks? So there was a definite building of rapport and trust that had to happen. And I'm very proud that we have built a nice rapport now with some district child care facilities, but it takes time and it takes some trust. And at the end of the day, we had to let them know we had no agenda other than helping them see the science that's there and helping to bring them some low to no cost recommendations that they can instill if they would like. These are my three little ones at our spring break last spring in the Grand Canyon, three of millions of reminders of how important all of this work is. So thank you for your attention. Any questions? Yes. Good question. One thing I didn't mention is that all the three pilots that we did in California, D.C., and Georgia have now surmounted into what we now have as the Eco-Healthy Child Care Program. So you can go to our website here, and there's a / at the end of org, and it's EHCC. It directly takes you to our national program. So we're working on the training side. We also have an endorsement side. In order to be endorsed, you have to fulfill some specific recommendations, again, science-based. We have now 16 science-based topical modules that make up our curriculum, but simultaneously we're also working in each state with the child care licensing arm, so trying to bring them the science, because right now we have to walk that fine line of not going against the current child care standards. For example, bleach is recommended, right? And there's a water to bleach ratio. We cannot go against that right now, but our hope is as we continue to bring them the science that's coming out of the CDC and all of that and making sure that they're using it in the way that it was intended to be used, not overuse, and not dipping toys in bleach solutions and breaking down those products every day and that kind of thing, but using mild soap and water. So we're trying to bring the basic public health practice of information to them right now while also trying fundamentally to change the back end, which is incorporating some environmental health standards pertaining to cleaning because it's so huge. And they're doing it all the time as they should. And the difference between sanitizing and disinfecting and what you need to do in those situations. And to be fair, there are some unique situations in childcare that might not be present in a K-12 environment as predominantly. Like, there's a concern with odor in childcare and the dirty diapers. So we even go through that, fragrances and, the things that you're bringing in that could very much be irritable and cause upper respiratory issues, if not onset of asthma, and a lot of even the people working in the facility, nonetheless, the families. So it's a process. It's not going to happen overnight because there are current standards right now in each state pertaining to how they clean and what they use. But we're just trying to encourage right now, while we're trying to help them change the paradigm a bit, that there are ways that you can use, for example, your bleach to water ratio that is how it was originally intended, to not go overboard. You don't have to bleach down every surface that child is working on every day long, or use the Clorox All or whatever it is. And of course, how you're using it, ventilating the space, making sure the kids are not right there when you're spraying. Now, if you're talking about water, feces, or urine, that's a different situation. That's a disinfection situation. But again, per the child care standards, the children should ideally not be right there when you're cleaning something up. But some of these facilities are very small. If it's in the middle of the winter, they don't have the ability to just send them outside while they take care of stuff. So, you know, it's all circumstantial, but we're trying to work on it in the current standards and making sure that they're not going too crazy and that they think about the use and how they're using and what they're using, that they're using one line of products, but we have alternatives that we offer as far as mixtures, lemon juice, borax, cornstarch, all these things that are out there, and the mixtures of which do the same thing that a lot of these very expensive, high-form chemical cleaners do. So, again, to the extent that we don't cross the line and get them in trouble with their current standards, we're also trying to change the paradigm of those standards, which is going to take some time. Sorry for the long answer, but that was a really important one to mention. Good question. So I'll take the cost one first. For example, there's our recommendation, again, focusing on the low to no cost, we are not going to go and say remediate the lead. What we first do is ask them to test. And we first ask them if they've been, you know, if the facility is older than in the 70s, of course, they'd have higher risk. We give them all that. We encourage them first to test. Then there's someone in the District of Columbia's Environmental Health Program that then would go out and do subsequent testing if there are alarming rates. And then our immediate recommendation would be to first seal that area, so the maintenance of the area, which are cheaper alternatives, which, again, we then pass off to the D.C. Department of Health, Keith Keemer, actually, in their air office, to then guide them through the process. But those are lower. We would encourage first the lower cost steps, you know, the sealants that you can put on, maintaining the windows and the door frames on a regular basis, reducing the amount of chipped paint, that kind of thing. On the mold, for example, there's no law against, unfortunately, mold control in any facility. So there's no entity that could close down a facility. I mean, obviously there might be other factors, but so we go to looking at the leak and whatever the moisture problem is, controlling that moisture. So we look at, you know, encourage them to look at the source of the problem because it will only get worse. But unfortunately, there are no ramifications to, you know, the mold issues per se. I mean, the same guy, the indoor air guy in the D.C. Department of Health, who's very busy, he would then again be called on, and he has contractors that he would recommend. So we'll do up to our point of, you know, helping them identify the concern, and then that's when we have to pass them off to the contractors and the folks in the D.C. government. It's a good question as far as how much what's the highest price tag someone, I mean, Peter, you might have thoughts in general on, you know, if someone has a leaky tile or something, or it's a pipe, you know, how much something like that would cost versus something bigger. Now, granted, the facility does get visited. I know in Maryland, for example, you get something like 2 mandatory visits and maybe 1 pop-up, or maybe it's vice versa. So there's 1 time or 2 times a year where you don't know when someone is coming from child care standard or regulation and you better have your ducks in a row. Then you'll have organized visits where you do know. And obviously people are very prepared for those. But you can't really hide a leaky roof or, you know, other moisture control issues. So when those are identified, those are brought to their attention. They're not going to close down the facility at that point, but they'll give them steps that they should be doing. I would say the steps don't go further enough, though. You know, so that's where, again, it's this interesting line that we have to walk as far as helping them understand that we're now getting into public health concern as well as maybe a moldy smell or some other circumstance that might be uncomfortable for those working in that space. But it's a very good point that maybe we can start. We actually have a session tomorrow, Rebecca, on making the economic case to a children's environmental health. So it's a good point for us to constantly be thinking about what are the pros and cons of, you know, the costs of making these alternatives. Any other questions? Thank you for that. So they all received in this pilot a certification that they made it through the training and all that kind of thing for what it was worth. In our national EcoHealthy Childcare program, which again, we absorbed a lot of the feedback into this national program that we have, there are posters that they get, there are decals, there are all kinds of discussion starters that we encourage for marketing. So it sets them aside. I mean, many parents and those that are taking care of children are looking for, you know, these type of standards in addition to the cost, you know, of childcare and all the other criteria that they're looking at. So it really helps to set them aside. So it's a marketing benefit. We also have a big national U.S. map where when an endorsed center is official, they get added to the U.S. map. So if I'm in Bethesda, Maryland, and I want to see who's endorsed and has at least started to make some steps in promoting environmental health safety or safer environments in their facility, I can go and look and see if there are any in my local neighborhood. So that's also another marketing tool for them. Yeah. Just this year, that's another presentation tomorrow at 4:30 or 4, 2:30. Yes, and this year our environmental eco-healthy childcare curriculum over the last year was incorporated into the National Center for Healthy Homes Community Worker Training Program. So we're very thrilled about that. So continuing to expand our reach into already existing, you know, very effective on-the-ground resources to help get the word out further. And thank you for HUD supporting that. Yes, very good point. So yes, again, due to limited staff capacity, we're a smaller staff, we did do the training evaluation right after, but the assessment, post-assessment, was done 3 to 6 months after our initial visit with them. I would say that I would wish that that would even be longer, maybe more like a year. It would give them more time to actually make some substantial steps forward, but that was the window that we had. But we did incorporate that into the national program as well, so that we now do environmental health assessments and on a rotating basis, and they get monthly hot tips from us. Like, they get regular communications from us. Did you know? It's a way of just circling back to the basic core guidance that they had in small snippets that they can easily digest and quickly get an email. Did you know? And it's, you know, some new research article that came up that we quickly translate in a couple lines and then lead them to some quick steps that they can take. It just circles right back. It kind of is a reinforcement to the original training. Thank you for that. I don't want to take up all the time. Thank you.